I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Do you drink pop or soda? Or do you say 40 Highway over Highway 40? Your answer has a lot to do with where you grew up. Today, from Wisconsin to Kansas, it's How to Speak Midwestern. Is our claim of being accent-free true? We'll find out and learn what separates the dialect of the Heartland from its Midwest neighbors like Illinois and Minnesota. Also, Ralph Nader shares an important message in an unlikely way. His latest book is a fable written in the spirit of Animal Farm and Charlotte's Web. We'll ask the consumer advocate and former presidential candidate why he chose this way to shine a light on the human impact on other species. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Edward McClellan has a new book out, How to Speak Midwestern. But what's the trick to speaking Midwestern? We don't have an accent, after all, as Edward points out in the book. Or do we? Still, we do have our ways with words. A roof over the house is a rough. To wash your clothes is to wash them. The best-known speaker of the Midwest dialect, Ed considers that to be Fred Rogers, the host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, as that person. But even Mr. Rogers had his tendencies. He said the word program as in TV program, as program. Edward McClellan joins us this morning by Skype. He goes by Ted, and Ted, welcome. Nice to have you.
Hi, nice to have you.
A lot of us think we don't have accents out here in the Heartland. To that, you say, that's not true. How can you be so certain? Because I don't hear it.
Okay, well, you know, one thing I say, well, everybody has an accent. If you went over to England, people would say, oh, you have an American accent. So it's all, it's all relative.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of one of the accents are an important part of regional identity and an important part of Midwestern identity is believing you don't have an accent. Now, Kansas City is in the Midland accent zone, and that's sort of something, it's not going to be parodied the way a Minnesota accent or an Arkansas accent is. As someone I talked to for the book said, it's sort of a transitional area from the northern edge to the south. People in most parts of the country wouldn't notice it was very different.
Right.
It's a national average because it's the middle of the country. Pronunciations are on a gradient, and it's in the middle of the gradient.
Huh. In fact, you say this in the book, you write, those of us from the upper Midwest speak a strain of English so revolutionary, it's changing the way vowels have been pronounced for more than a millennium. What do you mean?
Well, that's the northern city's vowel shift, and that's heard in what you call the inland north accent region, dialect region, which goes from Rochester, New York on the east to Milwaukee on the west. So some things you might recognize would be the A sound. People would say can, or in the O sound, people would say box or pop. Or I guess you're going to play one of the Superfans clips. They talk about Polish sausage. So that's a feature of the northern city's vowel shift.
Well, let's listen to what Ted just mentioned here to possibly one of the most famous examples of a Midwestern accent. This one of the Chicago variety is from an old Saturday Night Live skit, Bill Swirsky's Superfans.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to another edition of Bill Swirsky's Superfans. I'm Bob Swirsky, and I want to thank everyone for sending those cards to my brother Bill, who recently had another heart attack. We are coming to you live from Ditka's here on Thanksgiving Day, a day for giving thanks for, or taking punishment from, a team that is known as the Bears. With me, as always, are the super fans. Gentlemen, how was your week?
Real good.
Fantastic.
Real good.
Fantastic.
Good. Any heart attacks?
I had one.
Had a couple.
Good. All right. Now, as you can tell, we're celebrating Thanksgiving here at Ditka's rather than in our homes. But it's okay. Our families understand.
Absolutely.
This year, the Bears are playing, and Ditka's has a 12-foot screen.
There's really no other place to be.
You know, obviously, that's a little bit overblown, Ted, but what are some of the quirks in there that you pick up on?
Well, you could hear him say absolutely. That was one. And he called his brother Bob Swirsky. And then there's the substituting the D for the TH, and that's something, you know,
the
I
Bears.
Was at a bar.
Yeah.
The Bears. Yeah, I was at a bar on the south side of Chicago not too long ago during a Bears game, and the guys were pretty much talking like that. It was not too far off. You still hear some older guys in Chicago talk that way. And then there's that D for TH, which is sort of a legacy of immigration, because English is one of the few sounds that has languages that has the TH sound. And people would come here and they just wouldn't want to put their tongue through their teeth, so they'd say dis and D's and dem and does, and it kind of got passed down to the generations. But that very skit, I think, has made people kind of back away from it because they saw it was being parodied and making them a figure of fun around the country.
So where are you from?
I'm from Michigan, but I've lived in Chicago for 20 years.
Have you analyzed your own speech?
Well, I hear myself do it. Actually, my publisher was making fun of me because I was talking, we were in Cleveland, and I was talking about this book called Poison on Tap. And she said, tap. So I definitely hear myself. Well, I didn't when I was growing up. I was like everybody else in the Midwest. I thought, well, we don't have an accent in Michigan. And then I was at the University of Michigan, and I was taking a linguistics class. There I go again, class. And I asked a student from New Jersey, well, what do you notice about the way Michiganders talk? And she said, well, you know, you'll say sand or band, that raised A sound that's part of the Northern City's vowel shift. And interestingly, in Missouri, St. Louis was traditionally a Midland speaking city, but it now participates in the Northern City's vowel shift, and because of its connection to Chicago along I-55.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there may be a divergence in the way Kansas City and St. Louis talk.
Yeah. I'm visiting with Edward McClelland. He's the author of How to Speak Midwestern. And I'm wondering for our listeners, do you think we Kansas Cityans have accents? What's a sure sign that someone is speaking Midwestern as far as you're concerned? 816-235-2888 is the number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Have you made any judgments about the way I talk, Ted, or is it too quick here?
I know. Well, you're on the radio, so you know, broadcast professionals learn to sort of bleach any regionalisms out of their speech. That goes way back. I have an anecdote in the book about Bob Schieffer,
mm-hmm.
when he went from a TV station in Texas to Washington, D.C., and the guy hiring him said, I don't think we'd be interested in anybody with a regional accent. So you're not going to hear a lot of strong regional accents in the TV or the radio business. I did hear somebody mention in the intro saying Warsh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Is that prevalent in Kansas City still?
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes you hear it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that to me is the signature Midland feature that marks you as being in the Midlands more than anything else. And what I was told was that it came from the Pennsylvania pronunciation of water. And you know, that sound, the A sounds like an O, and you can put an R in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that sound got altered. And of course these accent regions all correspond to the settlement patterns. People in the middle of the country all came from originally from Baltimore and Philadelphia and moved west, and people in north came from New England, and people way up north in Minnesota, they came from Sweden and Germany and Finland, and so they have some characteristics of those Scandinavian languages.
I'm wondering what got you thinking about this idea of how to speak Midwestern. I mean, was it that day when you asked your sister-in-law how far it was to Dallas, and and she didn't know what city you were talking about based on the way you said it?
Well, I asked her, how far is it to Dallas? And she said, to where? To Dale's house? So... Definitely when I go to Texas, I have an accent. It came out of writing an article about the Northern City's vowel shift. And then as I got more into it, I said, okay, I want to you know, show that yes, we do have an accent in the Midwest, and that we're not just a the bland, generic, middle of the country. We have ways of speaking and words that are just as colorful as New York or the South or any place else.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls here. Good folks calling in. Ted, Leah from Lee's Summit. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I used to live in Raymore, Missouri when I was a kid. And at the high school, there was a lot of how about that? And it sounded a little more Southern, while later in life, now I live in Lee's Summit. And I've noticed even within a 15-mile distance, there's more of a Northern accent.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that make?
Where are those on the map?
Just a little.
It's in central Missouri. Kansas City would be the main city you'd think of, as, and then Lee Summit and Raymore would be suburbs, I guess.
Yeah, suburbs of Kansas City.
Raymore's a little
Ted.
More to the south. Yeah,
okay.
Suburbs of Kansas City.
Well,
Raymore would be more to the south.
I know, and I studied St. Louis more than any other part of Missouri, but in St. Louis, definitely people have been adopting more of a northern style of speech, I guess, because it's considered more sophisticated.
Yes.
So it could be the same factor going on.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And there's a lot more people from the country, Raymore.
Yeah.
While Lee Summit's been more populated.
All right.
One thing I'm interested in learning about from you, the listeners, is who says Missouri and who says Missouri?
Leah, how do you answer that?
I say Missouri, and I think those that are more closer to the Ozarks say Missouri. Am I right?
That's
my sense.
Yeah.
Well, I guess Senator McCaskill did two separate radio spots, one in which he said Missouri and one in which he said Missouri, playing different parts of the state. So there is a little bit of a northern-southern divide or urban-rural divide between Missouri and Missouri.
I think that's absolutely right, and I'm aware that the senator has done that on occasion, yes. So, yeah. Leah, thanks for the good call. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Ted, I want to talk a little bit more about this northern cities vowel shift, that this phrase. Hey, did you coin that phrase?
No, not at all. I mean, that was by a very famous linguist named William Labov from the University of Pennsylvania.
Very simply, explain what that vowel shift is again.
Well, it's a series of shifts, and it starts with the what you call raised A, what makes C-A-N sound like can. And, of course, then other vowels move into other positions. So you have B-O-X sound like box, which would be like almost like an A sound. And then I was at the post office in Michigan last week, and somebody said something like, oh, that'll be 3770. Will that be credit or debit? So the E sounds like a U. So these vowel sounds are moving into what used to be the territory of other vowels. And so there's sort of a chain reaction going on. And it's definitely made upper Midwestern speech more distinct from the rest of the country. You know, if you went back to the 20s, people might not think people from Chicago sounded like so different enough to parody. And Saturday Night Live actually did another parody of it based on my hometown. It was called 1-600 Lansing, and it was about a phone sex line for men who like women with sexy South Central Michigan accents.
Let's go back to some calls. Kite from Kansas City, Missouri. Kite, good morning.
Thanks, Steve. I wanted to report on my wife, Marty, I think you've met years ago, was from Ireland. We went to a restaurant in Massachusetts, and the people sitting at the other end of the restaurant, it was late in the evening, she said, those people are from Kansas City. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, no, they're from Kansas City. I turned and looked at them, and I knew three of them from Kansas City.
Huh.
So to me, that demonstrated that Kansas City has a special accent.
That's interesting.
Well, what do you think makes Kansas City distinctive? What do you think are the distinctive features of the Kansas City accent?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Okay.
because I guess I've got it.
You know it when you hear it, though.
You never hear it when you do it.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I talked to somebody from Michigan who lived in Boston for a while. Her name was Bonnie, and she called someone and left a message, and they spelled it out B-A-R-N-E-Y. So
I appreciate the phone call, Kite. Let's hear some examples of this vowel shift that Ted's talking about here. This is a clip of a young woman from Rochester, New York, talking about a night out with friends.
So I started doing this when I'd be out with my friends. We're all dancing, having a good time, got hot girl disguises on. Not in the mood at all to get hit on. Can't you see we're having a girls' night? We do not want to talk to you. Now, don't get me wrong. 99.9% of the time, I will talk to anyone that comes up to me, and I am super nice. You can ask anyone. It's a fact.
And the second clip we have here is a couple of Cleveland Browns fans talking about a trip to a football game.
The first game that my husband and I took our 2.5-year-old son Max to see. We had discussed for weeks whether he should attend the game only or give him the full experience and take him down to the Muni lot to tailgate.
This was the place that where when 1 o'clock rolled around, the fans had made their way from the tailgate parties in the Muni lot and brought their party around the mud field, which was painted green. We all wore our hearts on our sleeve to show our passion for our city, for our team, and even our beat up old stadium.
Yeah, what I played that one when I did a book event in Ohio last week. You're talking about our 2.5-year-old son, Max. And, you know, our Max. Passion for our team.
That's what you're talking about here, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's interesting that Rochester, you played that one. That's sort of where the Midwestern accent begins. And there's even, it's even said to be the pop soda line. You know, saying pop is just a marker of Midwesternism. It's said to lie between exits 41 and 42 on the New York State Thruways.
Yeah.
In Syracuse, they say. They say soda, and then in Rochester, they say pop. And if you're driving east west on the New York State Thruway, all of a sudden you get there, and they're saying, oh yeah, you want to go to Rochester? So you start hearing that elongated O right there.
Well, just quickly, let's talk about some of the general rules you lay out in the book, How to Speak Midwestern, about what it means to speak Midwestern. Number one, talk through your nose, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. Midwestern speech is nasal. So try talking as though your lower jaw has fallen off and you have to form words with the rest of your face. And you'll be on your way to achieving Midwestern nasality. Some people have said that the Midwestern accent sounds like a pirate with a head cold. You have to, you know, really emphasize your R's. I'm going out to the garage to work on my car's engine.
Yeah, I was going to say, don't just pronounce your R's. You say draw them out as much as possible.
Oh yeah, especially they do that in Iowa. Yeah, we're going to the Career Center on Friday, then we're going to a restaurant.
Omit vowels, get rid of them.
Yes, that's definitely what they're doing in Iowa. They're going to the Career Center.
I like number four. If you must criticize, do so passive aggressively. What do you mean by that? So, I think I know what you mean by that, but what do you mean by that?
Well, Midwesterners don't like to sound critical or hurt anyone's feelings, so we develop code words that allow us to avoid stating an opinion altogether. The most important are interesting and different. If something has merit, but you don't personally care for it, it's interesting.
What do you think
of the Vikings Stadium? Oh, it's interesting. And the story is told of a consultant who presented an idea to a group of Minnesotans and thought it was going over well because they all said it was interesting. And then what do you think of that mural under the Wilson Avenue Viaduct of three dolphins with the Queen of the Nile?
Yeah.
That's pretty. And then I have the anecdote about a New York Times article about the reaction to the movie Fargo in Minnesota. And they quote a guy who came out of the movie and he said, well, that was different. Most damning review you can possibly get in the Midwest.
Rule number five, mispronounce foreign names. We don't do those very well.
Yeah, well, that's
I don't do those very well.
I certainly heard a lot of that in St. Louis, or as it should be, San Luis.
Mm-hmm.
There's a street, G-R-A-V-O-I-S, which in French would be Gravois, but they call Gravois.
You've already mentioned a carbonated beverage is pop, not soda. And there's also the last one is you guys. People say that a lot. And when I was living in Dubuque, I was in Iowa, my second newspaper, the phrase up there was use. Hey, use guys want to go out to, you know, and go shopping now?
Yeah.
I never heard
that
before.
Yeah, well, I think you – oh, you never heard that? I think it's useful. I mean, that actually came from Irish immigrants, and because, you know, English doesn't have a second standard person plural, and their language did. So they said, okay, we'll just add an S to you, and it's plural. So it's use. And that's something, you know, you don't hear as much anymore. I think Archie Bunker killed it off. Nobody wanted to sound like Archie Bunker. although in the South, and probably if you go down to the Ozarks, you probably would hear y'all. That's perfectly acceptable down South.
Yes. Well, Edward, Ted McClellan is the author of How to Speak Midwestern. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, and The Nation. He joins us this morning via Skype. And Ted, thanks so much. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to make it to Kansas City. I didn't really get into Kansas City in the book, but if there's a future edition, I want to come to Kansas City.
I hope you will, and come by and see us, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Time for a break here. When we come back, Ralph Nader. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, our smart money experts had advice for managing your investments as the stock market reaches an all-time high. You can listen to that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we speak with a visionary who thinks 18th and Vine is a prime location for the next Silicon Valley. Also, Cindy Hodel is back with the latest on everyday life down in the Flint Hills. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. We know Ralph Nader for his groundbreaking consumer advocacy. A half century ago, it began with his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, that ripped the automobile industry over its lax safety practices. Since then, he's been taking it to corporate America with steadfast regularity. In 2000, he arguably cost Al Gore the White House with his Green Party candidacy. Today, Ralph Nader joins us to talk about something else entirely, his new book, Animal Envy, which is a fable featuring talking animals that puts us humans in our place over the damage we end up doing. Ralph Nader is a consumer advocate and author of Animal Envy, and welcome back, Ralph. Nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Steve. And it wasn't arguable in 2000. It was scapegoating. Even Gore knows that the Green Party wasn't the factor. It was Florida Supreme Court.
We're going to get to that right after we talk about your new fable here. And I'm thinking, a fable, Ralph? Really?
Yeah, I think it's a way of communicating. Historically, you know, the bit-by fables with animals having human commentary came out of India and then into ancient Persia, and then they came, similar fables came, and we studied and read them in elementary school. And I think animal envy is a way of reaching people all over the world, no matter what the culture, language, background, age, and its messages are extremely relevant today. So I like millions of other people, maybe billions, Steve, have always wondered, what would animals tell us if they could communicate to us?
And here you are telling us, right?
Yeah, and I don't mean just mammals. In this Animal Envy, there's 100 hours of global TV assigned to the animal kingdom and the elephant, owl, and dolphin become the producers, the managers, so they can figure out how and who gets on when, and that's controversial between insects and reptiles and birds and fish and mammals. So there's some of that.
Well, I'm looking at Danny Alexander, our producer, Ralph. I'm wondering what animal she thinks she is here today.
Well,
the dolphin, she says, yeah.
Well, because of this wonderment, and it starts with little experiences I've had watching squirrels make spectacular leaps between twigs.
Yes.
30, 40 feet high. And I've never seen one miss.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have this view that all these animals are stupid and they're just driven by their genetic instincts. And of course, recent scientific studies have shown multiple intelligences. Extraordinary. You know, like elephants not just have good memories, they have sorrow, grief, compassion, empathy in their herds. The more we find out about these multiple intelligences, I think the more we respect them, we won't try to destroy them, extinguish them, destroy their habitats, simply because they become more intriguing to us. We can learn from them. I mean, the latest scientists are in awe, Steve, of the detection capabilities of whales, moths, dogs. I mean, think of your average household dog in terms of hearing and smelling capability yeah. compared to humans.
Well, what drove your interest in animals, Ralph? Because this is new turf for you a little bit, isn't it?
Except for my critique of industrial agriculture, where they pack chickens, pigs, and cattle, as you know, in Kansas, so much together for profit maximization, these giant industrial agriculture areas, that they pump them full of hormones and antibiotics. And, of course, that ends up in the people's bodies who eat them. So I was always interested in the cruelty of that as well as the theme. I mean, that illustrates a lot of animal envy, which is if we mistreat these animals, it's going to boomerang back on our own health.
And Ralph, you're trying to achieve what here with your new book, Animal Envy?
I want to provoke people's imagination to look at the natural kingdom, the animal world, in a different and more comprehensive way. I mean, right now, we look at them as pets. We look at them as animals in zoos. We look at them through the National Geographic lens, giraffes roaming in Africa, and they're going down in numbers, too. But we have to look at them at least with three ways. One, that they have enormous amount to teach us because their organisms can do things we cannot do in terms of smell, detection, communication. Radar in World War II benefited from knowledge about owls, how owls at night avoid crashing into barriers. That's one. And the second is it teaches us humility. There's a passage in Animal Envy where the beetle that's the core borer that's destroying so many ash trees in the Midwest, millions of them, and the borer gets on the TV and basically says, I've just got half a minute. Here's what I'm going to tell you, humans. We keep multiplying, and we're going to destroy all your ash trees. And no matter how many woodpeckers you put on us, no matter how many parasites you import from Asia to get us, we are out producing. And nothing can stop us. And I know this is unfriendly, this borer beetle says to the humans, but I want to say this to teach you humility. and of course, you know, a lot of the viruses, the bacteria, come from the animal world.
Mm-hmm.
About two-thirds of human contagious diseases, at least, come from animals. So mosquitoes with the malarial parasite, for example, being one. So we've got a lot to learn, listen, and respect. And those are the three words. And there's a lot of humor in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point about in the 50th hour of global TV with, you know, billions of people mesmerized by by being able to listen to what sharks want to say to the people, what the locusts want to say, what the hyenas want to say. And but there comes a point when humans get distracted with their cell phones and all, and the ratings go down. And so the human genius who is behind this says to the triad, the elephant, dolphin, and
yes.
the owl, well, you better come up with something fast. You know, humans have short attention spans. And so they figured out, well, humans are sex obsessed every day of the year. And we're not. We view sex for reproduction only. Maybe if we show them our mating picture, maybe they'll come back. Of course, it worked like a charm, right?
Sure.
So it's a small book. It's a lot of scientific information. It's a great gift for the holidays, if I do say so myself.
You call this conversation with the animals on TV the great talk out, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The idea for this book came from where, Ralph?
Well, it started really when I was a kid, and my father and mother had a victory garden. Franklin Roosevelt told us all to have victory gardens in World War II because there was rationing. And there was this rabbit that was ravaging our garden. And so my father said, you know, see if you can spot it and chase it away. And one day I did spot it, and it was munching on some carrots. And so I ran after it, and I caught up to it. And the rabbit froze, and I had a big rock in my hand. And the rabbit just froze and looked at me. And something held me back. I couldn't hit that rabbit with the rock, and the rabbit scampered away. I think that's when I realized that I'm not your average hunter. I couldn't harm animals like that.
Yeah. Ralph Nader is my guest, the great consumer advocate. His new book, Animal Envy. Ralph, can I tell our listeners how old you are now?
82.
You know, I'm wondering how you feel about, you know, the human race after a career spent questioning and poking at corporate greed and profit-driven automakers who forsook, you know, safety, and now humans who have pulverized so many species of animals. Are you down on people, and should you be down on us?
Well, remember, the majority don't want to do that. The majority want to nurture the earth because they want their kids to breathe clean air and drink clean water and eat safe food and be able to enjoy the national parks and the forests. It's when too much power is in the hands of too few people who decide for the rest of us that the trouble starts. And when these too few people have commercial instincts, they're driven by profits, then they subordinate the civic values that spell a civilization and the human values that really count. And over the last few decades, we have lost a lot of ground to the supremacy of commercialism allied with big government, big business, big government, the corporate state, subordinating these civic values, which include respecting and nurturing nature. So we have the vast majority of people on our side. It's just a matter of building a powerful and deep-rooted democratic society so that the few cannot control the many. And we're really heading into some pretty stiff headwinds on January 20th with an even more explicit union of big business and big government. So any time in American history where civic values were supreme over commercial values were read the law, like you're going to have seatbelts, you're going to have safer food inspections and tests. They adjust because commercial institutions are very expedient. If they read the law and they can't get away with it, they'll adjust, just like they adjusted to the abolition of child labor over a century ago in dungeon factories. But that's what happened when we set up our national forests over 100 years ago and our national parks with Yosemite and Yellowstone. The landed interests were told there are certain areas that are off limits.
Right.
They're going to be available to all people for future generations. So that's what we got to do. We got to all be much more civically engaged in every way that suits our interest, time, and temperament. There's plenty of opportunity to be civically engaged in Kansas and the local, state level,
right,
and national.
You know, a lot of folks, Ralph, you know, might say, yeah, we care about the earth and people would describe themselves as being friendly to the environment. But then if you ask people, would they pay more money, either in higher utility bills or in other types of taxes to help preserve the environment, stave off global warming, you know, you might get a different response entirely. What do you make of that?
Well, that's income stratified, Steve. There are poor people who buy food that's not good for them, a very starchy food, because it's cheaper.
Right.
And so what you just said is accurate. If you raise the minimum wage to what it should have been, adjusted for inflation since 1968, it would be $11 and change an hour. And if they go to $15. So the more income people have, the more they respond to polls where they say, yeah, they will pay more for cleaner air. They will pay more for safer food. So it is income stratified. It's not value stratified. If you're up against it, you go and you buy the stuff that'll fill you, which may not be the best for you, but it's the cheapest. But as you get a more livable wage, that's when the environmental ethic kicks in. I'm telling you, it goes as high as 85, 90% over the decades when that question is asked. People are willing to pay more, for example, for cars that are less polluting, more fuel efficient. Not that they always have to. A lot of times the environmental option just is a matter of better engineering design.
Right.
And so it doesn't cost anymore. I mean, right now the amortization of seatbelts is you know, that doesn't cost anymore.
Right.
You know, airbags, it's all part of the price of the car. So we found, for example, that cutting air pollution actually increases profits for the company. They have fewer claims, fewer workers' compensation, fewer insurance payouts and premiums. So assuming it does cost more, people still say they'll pay more when they have a reasonable income.
You know, a few minutes ago, you brought up Donald Trump. You said just the other day, Ralph, that this could be the most dangerous period of American history with Trump at the helm. You say that, why?
Because everything involves his ego. He has a bruisable ego, and it's a big ego. And anybody who gets up at 3 in the morning to Twitter against a retired Miss Universe or some columnist that criticized him, when you think he has something better to do as president-elect, psychologically unstable. And he said it himself. He said, anybody criticize me, I'm going to lash back 20 times more. And he wants to have his say on any critic. Well, when you're president, you're never going to have enough time to respond to your critics. However, you get a head of state overseas attacking him, he could go crazy. You have a stateless terrorist attack on the U.S., the scale of 9/11, he could turn into a monster.
That's your biggest fear, you said, that his potential response to terrorism
could be hugely overreactive abroad, creating more boomerangs. Well, we've already overreact. For example, the invasion of Iraq and this metastasizing throughout the Middle East under Bush and continued some respect by Obama. Look what that has brought us, and trillions of dollars and soldiers dead and Iraqis, huge fatality toll. But he is surrounded by people who aren't going to restrain him. He's got this National Security Advisor, retired General Matt Flynn, who even scared the generals in the Pentagon, and he was let go from his post, and he wants to bomb Iran. And you have the Secretary of Defense, who's more level-headed, more knowledgeable, Mattis. He was very aggressive on Iran. Well, you know, Iran is not Iraq. Iran is not Syria. You do war with Iran, and you're going to have hundreds of thousands of U.S. soldiers involved. So as it spreads. So that's the fear. And then back home, he's fully able, given his attacks on the media, his generic attacks on the media, of crushing free speech and our civil liberties, shouting, terror, 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 we have to fight the terrorists. So this is a very dangerous period. I think the voters, the workers who voted for Trump, should keep a clear check on him. They should test him every week. Has he produced his promises to give us a better living? Has he produced his promises to bring back some of the industry? Or was it just phony political posturing like the coal industry or the steel industry? I think if he sees his own base shrinking, even though he's going to go around to large crowds and he's going to spend a lot of time hoop-plowing, it might restrain him. There are some good things. Someone with a bruisable ego is susceptible to flattery. So if a group of Nobel Prize winners and leading engineers visit him at the Trump Tower as he's entertaining delegations these days, the fact that they respect him and urge him to recognize scientific studies and analyses, it might work. So, however, you know, that's not the way we should have to deal with the president, trying to psych out his personal and psychological idiosyncrasies. What I'm troubled with is he's fact-deprived, and he's proud of it. He doesn't really want to study what these departments and agencies are supposed to be doing. And he's appointing, in my judgment, extremely extreme people who know what their mission is, which is to dismantle the mission of the departments and agencies that they're heading, such as Department of Education, Environmental Protection Agency, Department of Labor. And if he lets them do that, you're going to get a huge resistance from the civil servants and from the people out there around the country who are going to lose their overtime pay, who are going to lose a lot of assistance that's helped them. Now, having said this, on the civil service, The bureaucracy needs correction. It needs more efficiency. It needs innovation. But you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yeah.
Ralph Nader is my guest. You know, Ralph, just the other day you called the Electoral College, which obviously just met yesterday and formally ratified Donald Trump as president, an antiquated, sadistic attack on democracy. How is it an attack on democracy, Ralph?
Well, because presidential candidates can win your popular vote, America, and lose the election. And that's exactly what happened. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote nationwide by 2.8 million votes, and she lost the election because the next hoop was the Electoral College, who took it away from her. And I think if you want democratic elections, you've got to have majority or plurality vote winners. And we've five times in our history of our country, the last time with Gore. Gore won the popular vote, was taken away from by the electoral vote, thrown into Florida with all the shenanigans and violations, ending up with a 5-4 judicial coup d'etat.
Right.
That's just anti-democratic. And it delegitimizes the election because the people who voted for the winner of the popular vote, and there's no country in the world that plays this type of two-hoop game, by the way,
mm-hmm.
the people who are winner feel they've been robbed.
Right.
And they get cynical or they get obstreperous. And it delegitimizes the election.
You think Bernie Sanders could have beaten Donald Trump, and you've said as much also recently, even as a self-proclaimed socialist, Ralph?
Yeah, because he's not a socialist. He's a New Deal, Franklin Delano Roosevelt Democrat. He's never asked for the nationalization of all the major industries and the banks and insurance companies and agribusiness. Nothing.
Yeah.
He's just a New Deal Democrat. That's why, in his phraseology, a democratic socialist like the social democratic parties in Europe, in Sweden, in France, Germany, basically, there are parties dedicated to abolishing poverty, full Medicare for all, good pensions, a more decent wage, good public transit, things like that.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, Steve, on the Electoral College, there's a move underway that's over halfway to neutralizing it, and your listeners might want to go to nationalpopularvote.com. nationalpopularvote.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's called an interstate compact, and this is only a little citizen group with six people in California started this. California has passed the law, so has Illinois, Maryland, New York, and others, and it's an interstate compact where they pledge they will give their electoral college votes to whoever wins the presidential popular vote, and they're already up to 165.
Ralph, let me just hop in here. I just got 30 seconds left. I wanted to ask you, you know, a lot of folks, as we've talked briefly earlier, are still angry at you for giving this country a George Bush presidency. And I know you say this is scapegoating, but many say the fact still remains. No Ralph Nader Green Party candidacy in 2000, no George W. Bush presidency.
Yeah, but no shenanigans, no loss of Tennessee. No 250,000 Democrats voted for Bush in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
No Supreme Court coup d'etat. I mean, there are 100 variables, any one of which would have put Gore in the White House, which is why he doesn't blame the Green Party. And the Green Party has every right to run for election in our democratic society. And the Democrats ought to get over it. They've been scapegoating the Green Party instead of looking themselves in the mirror and why they can't landslide the worst Republican party in history.
That's Ralph Nader, his new book, Animal Envy. Ralph, I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks very much. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet.
Thank you, good listener.
You bet. All the best. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me. I'm at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, meet a visionary with hopes to start a Black Silicon Valley in the heart of Kansas City. Also, Life in the Flint Hills with Cindy Hodel. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. Our senior producer, that's Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.